There has been a lot of talk recently as Abraham Weisfeld has won his court case against the University of Quebec at Montreal, contending that universities no longer have the right to refuse doctoral thesis based on the personal beliefs of those members of the doctoral thesis review panel. Universities must, therefore, confine themselves to strictly analyzing the academic side of doctoral theses. Mr. Weisfeld, how are you doing this morning, sir?
Very well. Thank you very much.
This case has been very, very widely discussed, but always in the academic context, always in the context of the precedent that your case has set for university students who will now be allowed to see their ideas get the audience that they deserve. In your case, however, and the 4 years it took you to win your case, the rejection of your doctoral thesis was not based on anything academic. It was based on the personal beliefs of the jury who were conducting that review. You. And your doctoral thesis specifically referred to the right of return of the Palestinian refugees to the state of Palestine, and it also introduced a new concept. We've heard talk of the one-state solution. We've heard talk of the two-state solution. Maybe you'd like to give us a little bit of background into what the no-state solution is.
Yes, the right of return changes the whole sort of lay of the land in that the two-state solution is no longer considered possible in such a context if the entire Palestinian nation is given its proper rights, and that is including the right of return for the Palestinian refugees, who are the largest refugee population in human history and now comprise some 5 million people, mainly around in the Middle East, but throughout the world as well, including here in Montreal. Mm. Now, the two-state solution, which was the point of friction, you know, with my thesis, only allows for the existing resident population of the Palestinians to have a certain civil representation and not even full sovereignty as an ordinary state, you know, would have it. What was proposed as a two-state solution was essentially some form of apartheid. And this was initially planned out by the Zionist theoreticians when Jabotinsky proposed that the Palestinians would be tolerated to about a 20% level of the population, which is what the Palestinians are presently in the Israeli citizenry. And such a percentage as the minority of a maximum of 20% could be tolerated within the Zionist ideological framework of a nation state. Now, that's the sore point.
20% population, that actually is the current ratio of Palestinians living within Israel. So that wouldn't change anything, because 20% is the status quo, and that's
right.
What we're trying to change.
That's what the Zionist state wishes to preserve, a maximum of 20% of the Israeli citizenry being 20% Palestinian. Now, the two-state solution is designed to maintain that cap of 20% on the Palestinians by allocating a certain territory as an autonomous authority to the remaining Palestinian population, which has not fled from the Palestine territory in total. So that would mean that those Palestinians who are living in the West Bank and in the Gaza would not be granted full citizenship, but they would be granted a certain territorial autonomy in which they could play in their sandbox, so to speak. Mm. And they're sort of given, you know, a certain sort of area in which to segregate that population. It's a program of segregation. That is what the two-state solution is.
So in other words, the Palestinian criticisms of a potential two-state solution simply be allowing Palestinians to have a flag and a song. Are these some things that you yourself feel would be the limitations of the two-state solution?
Yes. That's what's called a two-state solution. Now, the original diplomatic treaty called the Oslo Agreement had a subtitle, which was an interim agreement. See, it wasn't presented as a solution initially. It was transformed into a solution by Prime Minister Barak at the point when he was negotiating with Yasser Arafat in the United States. Now, the point is that giving the Palestinians their own authority and a certain position on the territory from which to set up an administration which could continue negotiations with the State of Israel, that is something which is within the parameters of diplomatic process. It is not a solution in and of itself, yet it was transformed into such, you know, presented as a solution as if that's the end of the road. Mm. by Prime Minister Barak, you know, when he changed that on Arafat. And that's why Arafat was obliged to reject that proposal at that time, because it cut out discussion of the status of Jerusalem and cut out discussion of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees and or compensation. So Arafat was obliged to reject that agreement, and then he was attacked by the United States and by the Zionist movement and lobby, saying that he had, chosen to reject peace. Hmm. And peace was defined as a secondary status for the Palestinian people as a whole.
Now, the two-state solution, it has its benefits, it has its drawbacks. The one-state solution has its benefits, it has its drawbacks. You introduced a concept to me that I had not heard of before, entitled the no-state solution. How do you see this as being an improvement on a two- or one-state solution?
The problem with the one-state solution is that essentially what exists now is one state called Israel. It's just that Israel doesn't grant, you know, citizenship rights, you know, the right to vote for the greater part of the Palestinian population. So the Palestinians are disenfranchised and are essentially treated as a non-existing population, even though they exist there, and are allocated a certain sort of role in the economy as a near slave labor. You know, it's the Palestinians who are building the colonies in the West Bank. It's they who are doing the construction of these colonies, you know, for the settlers, you know.
Because they have no other economic means of survival, and their treatment by Israel, I would compare to the treatment of untouchables in India, in the caste system.
Yes, there's a caste. You know what even Marx called a social order, which goes beyond a class. A social order is a group of people who, usually by some national identification, are put aside and not given the same sort of social status as the population which is forming the base of the state itself, you know, the nation state itself, which was initially proposed by that German philosopher Hegel, who I critiqued in my thesis, and I explain, you know, what the alternative is there. Now, even if there was a egalitarian, you know, unitary state called Israel-Palestine or Palestine-Israel or Israel-teen, you know, you have to go beyond that, because the very concept of a nation state or a state per se assumes under liberal democracy that you have rule by majority. Now, if you have rule by majority, that means that the majority rules over the minority. Now, either one nation or the other is going to be the majority, and they would rule over the second nation, which neither nation would accept. So therefore, the whole concept of, you know, a majoritarian, unitary state fails just because of that reason alone.
Would you view Israel's stubbornness to maintain Israel as a religious state in opposition to democracy?
Well, there's a mistake in the question.
Okay.
Because there's no contradiction between democracy and theocracy. See, what we have in liberal democracy, small l liberal democracy, is a theory, a constitutional theory of social order that grants a certain predominance to a particular nation and to a particular religion associated with that nation. So in the West, in the Occident, we have nation states which are basically theocratic states because they're based upon a Christian religion, either one church or another. And this is what the whole Reformation was all about. It was a rebellion of the Protestant religious national formations against the Roman, theocratic empire of the Roman Holy Catholic Church, and they each set up their own sort of nation state. In Germany, it was Calvinism. No, in Holland, it was Calvinism. In Germany, it was Lutheranism. In England, it was Anglicanism. In the United States, it's Episcopalianism. And in Canada, it's Harperism.
I certainly hope that that's not becoming a religion.
Well, maybe not, but he certainly seems to think so.
You brought up Marx earlier, and it was Marx's contention that no state that defines itself as a religious state can ever be a true democracy, because as long as there are some members of that state who follow the religion and others who don't, there will always be that unfair treatment between the two parties. And the flip side is that if everybody did follow the religion of the state, then there would be no need for a democracy, because everybody would be on the same page.
Basically, that's what the dynamic is in the liberal democracies, in that people are obliged to assimilate into a particular particular religious culture, especially at this time of the year, and in which it's considered to be, you know, a state holiday, you know, and everyone is given time off, you know, because it happens to be the time that belongs to a particular religion, which has predominance. Now, Israel seeks to do the same thing. You know, what the Zionist movement sought to do was to establish a state in its own name that sought equality on the basis of establishing its own nation state, because the Jewish people could not find equality within the framework of the European Christian nation states. Therefore, the solution as presented by the Zionist ideologues was, well, if a Jewish people cannot have equality within the liberal democracies and the nation states pre-existing, therefore the alternative is to set up a nation state of its own in which it would operate on the same basis and impose its own majority upon, you know, that particular territory. And then the territory of Palestine was chosen subsequently, and the Palestinians were dispossessed, you know, in accordance with that, you know, theoretical framework. So,
which is the crime that we are still trying to solve 60 years later.
Yes, but it can't be solved by setting up another state form. The state form per se is the problematic. The state is the feature of, you know, modernism that arose in Europe, basically, subsequent to the Reformation and the Renaissance, and was a form that was imposed upon each and every state until, you know, the contradictions within those particular states, you know, grew to be too severe, like in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it would split up into a given national constituents. But then each national constituent itself, you know, had a minority population that would, you know, present a problem that would perhaps split off ad infinitum, you see. And then the number of states continues to increase, continues to perpetuate the same problem again and again. This is what the Parti Québécois proposes to do here in Quebec as well.
Let me ask you two questions based on the facts that you've given us. First of all, would you consider the claims that Israel makes that it is the only true democracy in the Middle East, would you consider Israel today to be a democracy?
Yes, precisely. It is. It is what is called a liberal democracy. But that just exposes, you know, the limitations of what a liberal democracy is. It exposes liberal democracy as a failure. And Israel is a failed state. It doesn't even exist, you know, in an economically independent fashion. You know, it's subsidized every year with $3 billion of American military goods to sustain it. Otherwise, you know, it would collapse.
That is what more and more, not just Palestinians are seeing, but that is what more and more members of the international community are recognizing as well. That is why the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement is going to be the tool that will cause this failed state to actually embrace its neighbors.
Yes.
You mentioned that the State of Israel was created because the Jewish people could not find within the European framework a place to practice their own statehood, their own nationhood. My question is, was that there for them to find, or is it the prejudice of the European nations at the time, which did not allow Jewish people to move into places like England, which did not allow Jewish people to move to Canada, to the United States, which put quotas on Jewish immigrants? Was that the reason why the English, the Canadians, the Americans created the State of Israel? Because these nations did not want Jewish people in their lands?
Oh, precisely. At the end of the Second World War, my parents, who were refugees, survivors of the Holocaust by escaping into the Soviet Union, they were in a refugee camp in Germany, and it took a year before they could get a visa to come into Canada, even though my father had a sister who was already resident in Toronto prior to the war. And others who didn't have, you know, relatives, you know, in any other country that could provide them with a sponsorship so that they could get a visa, were obliged, you know, to go to Palestine because they had nowhere else in the world to go. And that was only 48% of the refugees. 52% of the refugees did not go to Palestine. 48% did go because they had no alternative. And they were conscripted, basically, by the Zionists into the military confrontation with the Palestinians, despite, you know, their own personal wishes in the matter. This is in spite of the fact that there was a territory in the Russian Empire under the Tsar and under the Bolshevik regime called the Pale of Settlement, which was in the area of Byelorussia and Lithuania. And there was a majority Jewish population that could have become an autonomous Jewish republic within the Russian Federation.
So there was an alternative to dispossessing the Palestinian people of their land.
Oh, yes. However, the leading ideologies of the time, both liberalism and the Marxist regime, refused to recognize the Jewish people as a nation. That is in a sociological term, and refused to allocate the necessary resources, that is, territory, so that the Jewish people could exist, you know, in a secure fashion. And this is a failure, one of the failures, you know, of the Bolshevik regime. Mm-hmm. Instead, as an alternative, Stalin set up a territory in the far east of the Russian Federation called Birobidzhan that was allocated for the Jewish people, basically a territory of exile for the Jewish people. In spite of that, 25,000 people went out there to live in the first year in 1926. And it still exists, but it's a diminished, you know, territory.
Hmm. Abraham, we only have a few minutes left here, and I really want to get the answer to this question. Me, myself, personally, I've always believed that the one-state solution will be the ultimate goal, but a necessary step on the way to the one-step solution is the two-state solution, i.e., Israelis and Palestinians must learn to live together as neighbors, equal neighbors first, via a two-state solution before they can live together in the same house via a one-state solution. I would like to hear what your idea of the no-state solution is.
There will be a transitionary period in which there will be two political authorities, one Palestinian, one is Israeli. And that will allow for the establishment of forms of civil society for each people that are appropriate, that give national cultural autonomy to each party. And then they can establish, you know, relations that are more appropriate because the populations are interspersed in any case. And there is a right of return of the Palestinians to those areas from which they had originated. Mm. And this can only be accomplished in a system of autonomy under a confederation, which would bring together both territories into a united social formation. But this would not be a state. It would be a no-state solution, in effect, which would grant a national cultural autonomy to each party within a confederation, in which there was interaction on a judicial and security level by means of a tri-party agreement, which would mean that, let's say, in the judicial setting, there was a conflict between a Palestinian and an Israeli. They would go before a tribunal of three judges, one Israeli, one Palestinian, and a third judge who was chosen by the two preceding judges. This is the tripartite system. Mm. The same thing could be done in terms of military security. And there would be a Israeli security force, there would be a Palestinian security force, and there would be a third security force which would make sure that the other two security forces don't come into conflict with each other. And then all three together would, of course, you know, be responsible for the security of the territory as a whole.
Now, would the Palestinians and the Israelis have to agree to who that third party would be? Or is the third party simply the international community as represented by the United Nations or as represented by some new world body that maybe we are still waiting for?
A third security force could be an international UN security force. Yes, it could be. And it could also be, you know, internal elements, you know, who would be responsible for the mutual security of both populations. Mm-hmm. It would work. Despite the popular sort of, you know, phrase that, oh, there'll never be peace, you know, because it's a conflict between two peoples.
It's a defeatist attitude that there'll never
defeatist,
be peace.
Yeah. It doesn't even recognize the fact that already 20% of the Israeli population are Palestinians who are living relative peace, you know, with the Israelis in 60 years, more than 60 years. Mm. So if they can do so, then why not the entire population as a whole?
Under a no-state solution, who would be responsible for day-to-day governance, such as public works, education?
Well, under national cultural autonomy, which is a concept that was elaborated by the Jewish Bund socialist movement of 1897 when it was founded, and elaborated in the thesis by Otto Bauer, who was an Austrian Marxist of the Social Democratic Party. This concept allows for each national culture to govern itself in terms of education, its own legal system, you know, any other sort of cultural feature that it requires. And in terms of governing, you know, of a particular sort of, you know, municipality, if a municipality was predominantly Israeli, then it would have a predominantly Israeli administration. If it was a mixed population like in Jaffa, then it would have proportionality. It would all be based upon proportionality, mm-hmm. a proportional representation system, you know, on a local level.
in order for that to work, there would have to be respect for that proportionality from the actual citizens within.
The scarce resources would have to be allocated on a proportional basis, like water.
That makes very clear sense. Do you see the future of mankind as 200 individual houses coexisting together, or will there eventually be a no-state solution for humanity as well?
Yes, this is what is developing in certain areas of the world, like the African Union is forming a confederation of all the African countries. The European Union is forming a confederation of all the European countries because they figured out, you know, that the system of nation states, you know, only leads to one war after another, and they've had enough of war, so they had to find some other way of doing it. And this is going to be, you know, replicated, you know, elsewhere in the world as well.
Very interesting talking to you today, Mr. Weisfeld. Maybe you can give the listeners some location where they can get some more of your writings, some more of your readings. You are the author of 3 books, and maybe some information about the recent court victory.
Well, my latest book is sabra-shatila.com, sabra-shatila.com. And otherwise, you know, my email address is saalaha@focus.name. That's salaha@focus.name. Salaha is Arabic for reconciliation. Mm. What people need to consider is that there should be no superiority involved, you know, in any sort of a given cultural experience. That culture is the essence of human intelligence, as is language, etc. And no culture should disappear in favor of any other culture. And there is no reason to believe that that one culture, you know, has the predominance, you know, for eternity. And this is the problem with the religions as they have been propagated, you know, previously. And they assume that they are the end of human intelligence, that there's nothing else to be learned, and that... theocracy is the only way to think. So we have to go beyond that, of course, and consider, you know, that we have an infinity before us, and we should enjoy, you know, the experience of learning more.
Wow. What an excellent way to sum things up. Very interesting speaking with you today. And we wish you all the best, and we will be speaking again on this and other programs. Thank you.